You're listening to Bicycle Talk. It is October 19th, 2016. My name is Ron Meneza, a.k.a. Peddlin' Ron. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about cycling, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or would like to contribute information to the show, please text us at or call us at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. So anyway, starting off the show, we have to start it off with Ron's Rant of the Day. Ron's Rant of the Day is an annual thing. We talk about things that...
I think it's a weekly thing.
A weekly thing. I guess it is a weekly thing. Well, annual is a week. I guess it's not. That's
no,
more
that's
of a year.
A year.
That's right. Okay, so it's a weekly thing. You're absolutely right. Annoying cyclists is the rant of the day. Okay. Don't be an annoying cyclist. What is an annoying cyclist? Things that annoy. People who ride against traffic, riding on the sidewalks, running stop signs. By the way, riding on the sidewalk, I almost got run over by a college student this morning while I was walking to the radio station. That drives me crazy. Get out on the road where you belong. Anyway, running stop signs and lights, turning without signaling, riding in the dark without lights, not sharing the road. And it's not generally cyclists are not annoying. It's that, you know, there's a moral order on the road. There's, you know, the cars and trucks and those of us who ride bicycles responsibly know that we're supposed to obey the laws of the road. And unfortunately, there's all it takes is one of those little standout annoying cyclists to make it bad for all of us and put a really bad memory into someone's mind about those cyclists. So anyway, don't be an annoying cyclist. Think about it. Get out there. Ride responsibly. That's it. Okay, moving on. I have a guest in here today. My guest today is Robert Enright, the pack tour guy from this summer's radio show and podcast. I was talking about you throughout the entire summer, and we like to go by Bob, right?
Yes, please.
Okay, so that's what we're going to do. I have to ask you the question that is asked of every guest that comes on the show, and that is, what was your very first experience on a bike?
I knew you'd ask me that question. And as a former lawyer, now retired, I figured I'd better come up with a plausible answer. But I don't think my answer will be a satisfactory one, because I thought to myself, how did it come to pass that I knew how to play baseball? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know how it came to pass that I first started to ride a bicycle. But I do know that way back when, I had this red bicycle before it got stolen in downtown Pearl River, New York, where I grew up. And it was a Czechoslovakian racer. And I remember...
Really?
Yeah, Czechoslovakian racer.
Wow.
And I remember riding that bike around. That was my first memorable experience with a bicycle. It even had a little wire basket on the front. But if you've played baseball, you've played it for so long, you don't remember when you started. And if you've ridden a bicycle, the odds are you've ridden it so long that it's just part of the whole fabric of your existence.
Well, we're not going to hold you to it. So
thank you. It's the
okay.
Best I can do.
Okay, that's fine.
And so by the way, started... thank you for the invite to this program. If I were not sitting here in the studio, I'd be stretched out at home listening.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thanks for listening, first of all, and also really great to have you on the show. Can you give us a little bit of your background history?
Well, I'm 66. I had a long career as a lawyer. I retired in 2015, and I then proceeded to undertake two transcontinental bicycle rides, the most recent one being mid-July of this year through mid-August of this year, which might be a good place for me to start. But I'd like to tie in a little bit with my discussion with what I heard last week when Michael Beatty was on the program, and I thought I'd pay a little homage to his remarkable achievement of riding around the perimeter of the United States, 12,000 miles and 150-plus riding days. I've never met him, but listening to him speak, you know right from the get-go, he's a real person and a gentleman, and I can see how people would warm to him as a cyclist and also warm to the charity that he was, whose interests he was advancing. But one of his themes was safety. And I think another theme implicit in his discussion was, if you're a writer, and you're writing as far as he wrote, for as long as he wrote, you're also an ambassador to the world at large, principally drivers on the part of bicyclists. And that was something I was mindful of on my cross-country excursions. Number one is riding safely, and I would submit that's intertwined with good road etiquette and riding as an ambassador of the world of bicyclists. So we left as a tour. It's about 45 riders and 10 support staff. It was quite a group. We left north of Seattle in a place called Everett, Washington, and we rode for 31 days on a northern arc across the United States of America. And we finished, they said Boston, but actually we finished in Salem, Massachusetts at the Atlantic Ocean. So it was a shining sea tour. And there were 2 days that we spent, it was actually transnational as well as transcontinental. We spent 2 days riding through Ontario province in Canada. And then we reentered the United States at Niagara Falls. So it's about 3,600 miles, 31 riding days. We had one rest day about midway through the tour. We took a ferry across Lake Michigan, which is a very welcome experience.
I'll bet you needed that by then.
We did. We averaged between 115 and 120 miles a day. You rode every day, rain or shine. You're on a tight schedule, and it was hard riding. It was one stretch of about 8 days where we covered 1,000 miles. It was hard riding, but it was a wonderful ordeal. And one of the questions is, what kind of safety measures do you undertake to make sure that you get from one coast to the other coast intact? And one of the measures that Michael mentioned was you got a strobe light in back and you got a mirror on your helmet. And another thing I learned in my decades as a bicyclist is if you're going to get on a bicycle and it's going to move, you got to have a helmet. And that lesson was borne out this summer, when we were in a little town in Wisconsin. One of the riders, somebody I knew I was riding with, was stopped at a four-way traffic light, waiting for the light to turn. He was going to make a left. And from his right, a car made a left turn, didn't see him, and nailed him.
Ouch.
And he went over the hood, hit the deck, suffered a lot of bumps and bruises, and broke his helmet. But he didn't fracture his skull. So though he took a hard shot, a couple of hard shots, he did not suffer a head injury, and he was able to get up and rally, and he lost a little bit of time, but he kept riding and completed the tour. So
so he was on your tour, and this happened in the middle of your tour?
This happened about the middle of the tour, and he did complete the tour. There were some mishaps along the way. One thing you learn is if you're riding in a pace line, you better know the people with whom you're riding very well.
Oh, God, don't even get me started.
Because mishaps can happen. There was rider.
Then we'll have another rant of the day.
Yeah, we'll have another rant of the day. Yeah, it'd be a separate rant.
There was one rider who was in a pace line, and there was a mishap. She went over, suffered a concussion. Riding with a helmet, but nevertheless, she suffered a concussion. She left the tour for about 10 days, but she came back and completed the tour.
Sure.
So safety is paramount, and I think it's, as I said, intertwined with etiquette. Now, my theory about these rides is I want to generate goodwill toward bicyclists. And to that end, I'm going to ride respectful of other riders and drivers, and also the rules of traffic safety. And in this regard, Lon Haldeman, who was one of the tour leaders, PAC Tour is a mom-and-pop operation, and it's really a two-person show, married couple, yeah, Lon Haldeman and Susan Notarangelo. They are both legendary bicyclists, and Lon won the Race Across America its first year, and he defended his title after that. But he told us this story. He said he was leading the Race Across America with about 300 miles to go, and he's in some little town in Pennsylvania. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. He's really tired, and he wants to keep pushing to get to the finish. His team is with him, and there's a red light in this town at 3 o'clock in the morning. Lon stops, waits for the light to change. And his crew is saying, come on, Lon, let's get going here. You know, you're tired and you want to push and let's keep going. And Lon just patiently waited for the light to change because he wants to respect the rules of the road. And
wow.
That was a rule that was informally enforced during the Transcontinental Ride, and one that I obeyed not entirely without exception. There was one time I ran a red light. It was 7 o'clock in the morning in some town, and the reason I ran it with several others, I didn't wait for the light to change, is because we kept going back and forth over what we thought was a trip line, and it never changed. So we figured we're going to sit here all morning until somebody's on their way to church. And then the light will change.
Yeah, that is the problem.
So, and I wasn't I'm not saying I was happy about doing that. In retrospect, I probably would not have done it. But that's one thing you really need to do. Respect those, the lights and the stops, the traffic and everything like that. Another thing we did was, if I'm going through a stop sign and there's a car to my right or my left or whatever, and I have the right of way, I take the right of way, I enter the intersection, I give a little wave to the driver, and that little acknowledgement means, number one, I see you, and number two, thank you.
Right, right, exactly.
And I try to do that, and other riders, I'm not the only one, other riders did that. We did that at stop signs, and we also did that when traffic lights change from red to green, and we're entering the intersection. We just give a little wave or nod of acknowledgement to the drivers to let us know that... we see them, and we acknowledge their existence, and we're grateful that our existence is duly acknowledged. So that was another little trick that we learned riding across country. Now, another theme from the show, and I've listened, I think, to all your just about all your shows, is, you know, the inevitable confrontation with a driver, mm-hmm. whether earned or not. And I'll tell one story from the Transcon, if I may. We were, somewhere in the Midwest, and there were about four or five riders in a row. It was not a pace line, but riders just riding one after another. They're all men in their 50s or 60s, rather sober, composed characters, not at all belligerent or aggressive or anything like that. And they're riding along, and a man in a pickup truck came by.
It's always a truck.
an F-999. And as he moved along that line, something provoked him. Maybe his innately nasty temperament. I don't know what. Maybe he was suffering from testosterone poisoning. Who knows? But he pulled over and gradually focused on one of the riders and edged that rider off the road to the point where there was contact between the pickup truck and the bicyclist. The bicyclist was forced off the road but was not injured. Now, this led to a brouhaha. The other riders, in effect, forced the driver to stop. And what then ensued was, I'm going to use the word confrontation, but there's a twist to this story. The riders who were not directly affected were incensed and were chastising the driver. But the rider who was forced off the road took a different approach, which, by the way, Ron, I think echoes a story that you told some months ago, which I happened to hear. That rider turned to the driver and said, would you do this if I were a member of your family, a friend of yours, a neighbor of yours? Would you be doing this? And that completely defused what was an antagonistic and unproductive situation. The driver backed down and felt duly sheepish and regretful of what he did. So by virtue of that rider holding his composure, and by the way, I'm a kind of temperamental, argumentative, combative ex-lawyer. I can't say that I would have had that kind of courage to take the high road. that rider took the high road, held his composure, and turned what could have been an ugly confrontation into a productive encounter with the rider, with the driver. And maybe the driver's better off for it. And maybe that goodwill will generate other goodwill.
You know, we have a friend of ours who lives here in town. She's a professional bicycle racer. Her name is Amber Pierce, and she calls it humanizing the situation.
Right.
And it's, you know, we are people on bicycles, and the drivers of vehicles are people in cars and trucks. And when you humanize it, it just changes the whole presentation, really brings it down a notch and makes it a lot easier to talk to people.
Now, my own experience on this tour was not unblemished. I tended to ride alone, and I had a couple of unfortunate encounters with drivers. One, I'm going down the Cascades on the east side, very steep descent. I'm twisting, winding back and forth, and I'm hanging on for dear life because I'm not that confident on the descent. But I'm riding along, and I get a big blast from a driver, and it occurred to me that I was probably out a little too far from the shoulder, maybe into the roadway, and I was maybe to some extent blocking off that driver from a more comfortable descent on his part. And I thought, well, I didn't deserve to get blown out of the saddle, but I might have deserved a little bit of a tap. It meant, you know,
so
pay
this
more
was
attention.
This was a horn blowing at you?
Horn
is that
blowing
what it was?
At me. Yeah. Mm. And a couple days later, actually maybe a week or two later, that I'm riding along on a back road, and once again, a driver beeps the horn, nearly blows me out of the saddle, and I wondered why, and it occurred to me that I was probably riding a little far off into the roadway, and I wasn't looking ahead. I was looking off to some side road, thinking I'd see Xanadu, I don't know what, but again, I should have been paying more attention, but I didn't think I deserved to get blown out of the saddle by this long blast on the horn, so... But the whole point—the point is, you have to be—you have to be vigilant. We weren't allowed to use headphones, anything like that. You don't want to do that. You want to be able to hear somebody shout. There's a Walmart semi the size of the Queen Mary bearing down on you. So get ready to take evasive action where the shoulder is 1 inch and it's a big drop off. So that was one of the themes. So, but I think it's really important. It's like when I'm in a foreign country, I always think to myself, I am the American. There's probably all these people out there in this who are the indigenous to this country who look at me as the complete embodiment of America and the American people. It's not true, but the fact is that's the reality. So I try to comport myself in a way that I create a good impression of what it's like to be an American. And by the same token, if you're riding cross-country, you want to create goodwill on the part of drivers towards cyclists. And that is something that almost everybody on the tour was trying to do. And we policed ourselves to some extent to do that. I think that going back to Michael Beattie, I think that he's another example of a real gentleman rider who's going to go out of his way to create goodwill and not antagonize riders, drivers, many of whom have kind of a chip on their shoulder anyway, or angry about something and that sort of thing.
Well, it's part of being an ambassador to the sport, you know, and it's something that Fran knows. I preach it all the time because it's important, because how I react reflects on how you're seen when you're out on the road, and how you react is a reflection back to how I'm seen on the road. So we kind of have to, you know, take care of one another, and that's a great way to do it. But and Mike is another good one. He's very
and,
good.
I was hoping that, you know, Mike had plenty to talk about. I was hoping that he would talk a little bit about what he saw as he rode 12,000 miles around the perimeter of the United States of America. And I thought I'd maybe digress a little bit from the issues of safety and etiquette to talk about the United States of America as seen from a bicycle seat 8 hours a day for about 30 days in a row. And I have to say that it is America the Beautiful is really true, and it's just amazing how you can ride 3,600 miles from coast to coast, and it's one country, and people actually do speak the same language. They might not share the same politics, and that's certainly the case, but they do speak the same language. And I have to say this, that for my talk about unpleasant encounters with motorists, I would have to say that I had many, many encounters with motorists and people, and this echoes, I think, what Michael Beatty was saying, that were really heartwarming and pleasant. I can remember I was riding in one state, Wisconsin maybe. I was riding by myself. It was a late morning, early afternoon, back road, overcast day, maybe rainy, by myself. And from the opposite direction, a man comes by in the ubiquitous universal pickup truck. He slows down and turns his head toward me. I wonder, what's he going to say? And he said, "You all watch out. You got to be careful. There was a bicyclist who was hit by a car here a while back, so just be alert, stay alert." So I said, "Thank you very much."
How nice.
I had a number of encounters with people like that. There are occasions where you're stopped at a sign or a light, and you're looking down at your cue card, and a motorist might say, "Do you need directions? Are you lost? Do you know where you're going?" And that was not uncommon for riders to have very pleasant interactions with drivers. And so by and large, I think I could speak for the entire tour that we're really happy with the way drivers treated us. And we tried to earn the respect and the solicitude of the drivers, and I think to some extent we succeeded. But to go back to what you can see when you're riding from coast to coast, you know, we started north of Seattle, and as I mentioned, headed on a northern arc across the United States. And you go through eastern Washington and then the Idaho Panhandle into Montana. And this was when we did this, it was a particularly pristine day. It was a day where we were riding for a long time along a river, blue sky, low humidity, green pine forests, lots of green, marshes, birds, local roads as well. And it was a day I felt so good. I think I rode 88 miles without getting off the bike. I rode all the way
wow.
to lunch. And
wow.
not that I'm such a great rider, but we might just have had a wind to our back. And the weather conditions were perfect. The road surfaces were excellent. The scenery was wonderful. There's really no climbing. And after that that day, when we all came back, one of the women on the tour said, "You know, that day, today's ride, the scenery was so beautiful, it brought tears to my eyes." And I thought, you know, it takes a woman to have the kind of courage to admit to that emotionality from riding a bicycle. And but other people might have also felt that same kind of emotionality. I can tell you that. That was one of the highlights of this tour, because the scenery at times is truly compelling, and the scenery is so varied, because you go from eastern Washington, across the Idaho Panhandle, hundreds of miles in Montana, and then South Dakota, where you spend days on like a two-lane highway, twisting and winding, up and down, very little traffic, range to the left, range to the right, big blue sky, hot sun, wind, hundreds of miles. It is beautiful, but a little trying on the patience.
It's big out there. It never seems to end.
You know what I'm
end.
Talking about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It is remarkable, but like I say, not easy. Then when you enter South Dakota, we wound up going through Custer State Forest, where if you wish, you can get as close as you want to get to wild buffalo, because the buffalo roam freely and they're wild. It is illegal and quite dangerous to get close to the buffalo, and I chose to keep my distance just close enough to get some good photographs. There was one rider who did get too close to a buffalo, a big bull, and they're huge, impressive, powerful animals. He got a little too close, and the bull became restive and then became upset, charged the rider.
Uh-oh.
And the rider held up his bicycle as a shield. Imagine that.
Yeah, that's going to work.
Shouted at the top of his lungs and just barely managed to deflect the charging bull. And he was really, that rider, who was in his 70s, was really quite shook up by the incident. But again, Custer State Forest, buffalo, antelope, prairie dog field. Imagine that. I'm from the New York area. Seeing a prairie dog field? other kinds of wild animals, just beautiful, beautiful scenery. So we went through South Dakota. The midpoint of the tour was Mount Rushmore. I'd never seen Mount Rushmore before, well worth seeing. The problem is to get to the top of Mount Rushmore, it's a 2 mile, 10% climb.
Ouch.
After 7,000 feet of climbing. And that was a tough haul at the very end of the day to go up that climb to Mount Rushmore. Then from South Dakota, we went through Minnesota and Wisconsin. And by the way, the American West, all through the American West, you see the iconic images of the West. You see the oil pump jacks. You see the windmills. you see the ranches.
Did you go to Wall Drug?
No, we missed that.
Oh.
I saw 1,000 signs for it. But
of course you did.
Yeah,
that's a thing that people, you forget to talk about that when you're driving across the country, all the really hilarious signs for Wall Drug.
I did see a hilarious sign for, I think we were in maybe Idaho, for the Testicle Festival.
Oh!
Oh, my God.
I know. That's a real photo op, believe me.
I'll bet it is.
But another thing we saw, trains. You hardly see trains in the Northeast. As you ride cross-country, you see gigantic, endless trains, freight trains, coal trains, tanker cars. And I have to admit, as they go by, you know, if you give the engineer the high sign, he'll blow that whistle for you. Long blast on the whistle. I thought, you know, I'm 66 years old. I mean, I got a thrill out of that. Maybe I'm going to grow up. Not yet, but someday maybe I will. So you see these. The West is about trains, fences, vast rangeland. Again, the pump oil pump jacks, the windmills, and so forth. Then when you get to the Midwest, it becomes the air becomes more humid. You know, you're on the road by 7:30. By 8 o'clock, 8:30, you're drenched. You're drenched all day. But then when you get to a place like Wisconsin, the topography is so radically different. Hilltop farms all across southern Wisconsin. And you get a sense of how rich this country is when you can ride for hundreds of miles and you see endless cornfields, you know, rolling over the hills. You stand there and you're looking back a mile and you just see gigantic cornfields. And these farms are very prosperous looking, very well kept. So that's Wisconsin. And then from Wisconsin, we crossed Lake Michigan on a ferry. We wound up in Michigan, went across Michigan, and then we went through 2 days in Ontario. Largely flat, hot, humid, not much climbing, but 130 miles a day, long days, tough going.
That's really hard.
Yeah, it's a test of attrition in a way. We wound up in Niagara Falls. We spent the night in Niagara Falls, so you can walk down, check out the falls, magnificent sight. Then the next day, into New York State, make sure you have your passport. You're going to get checked at customs. Twice we got checked, once going from into Canada, once coming out of Canada. Then we're in New York, and we spent 2 or 3 days riding from west to east across central New York. Now, right there in Niagara, New York, just over the border at the beginning of the day, it's where I had my own little mishap. it was a pouring rain, and we had to go over railroad tracks. And I remember you have to make the tracks are approaching. And I said to myself, these are railroad tracks. This is what you have to do to get over these railroad tracks without going over.
Right.
And I'm consciously trying to make sure that happens, but I don't think I was going fast enough. So hit the tracks, boom, over I went. Fortunately, it happened so fast that I didn't put my hand out to break the fall, so I landed right on my side, banged my shoulder, but I was able to get up, keep riding. Finished the rest of the day, 120 miles to go. That was my only only mishap. And
after falling, you had 120 miles to go.
120 miles, but I was lucky. I didn't break anything. I was lucky.
You are,
but
yeah.
I guess the moral of the story is you got to do your best when it comes to safety, but you're not going to give yourself an insurance policy that you'll be immune from any and all mishaps. So we went through central New York. Now I'm a native New Yorker, and I grew up in Rockland County in the southern tier of New York. And we went through these central New York towns like Seneca Falls, which is famous in American history. Some people would say that the birth of the American feminist movement occurred in Seneca Falls. But
and that's where Bedford Falls from It's a Wonderful Life really is.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. We went through Seneca Falls, other towns along the way, ultimately Saratoga, a wonderful town. And one of the things about this trip is you go through so many places where you just say to yourself, you know, I'd like to spend a day in this town. I'd like to check this historic site out. I'd like to learn more about the history of this town. I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask. You'd like to do that, but you can't because you're going from place to place. You're on a tight schedule. You're here. Next day, you got 120, 130 miles to go. You got to keep pushing. So we went through New York State, through Saratoga, wonderful town, into Vermont, and the trip from Saratoga across the New York border into Vermont. Beautiful, picturesque, rural country. Really nice.
It's really pretty up there.
Really pretty out there.
Yeah, it is.
We wound up spending the night in Bennington, Vermont, went through the town of Bennington, kind of a quintessential New England charming college town. Big climb out of Bennington, like a 5-mile huge climb up some gap.
You must have taken Route 9 out of Bennington.
We might have taken Route 9.
Yeah. So which gap is that?
Oh, I don't know. It's Route 9 that goes between Bennington and Brattleboro, and it's a pretty long climb because there's a ski area up there.
It's not Middlebury.
No. You're way south. You're really on the Massachusetts line at this point.
Oh.
You're way, way down there.
So then we shift. We had a kind of cup of tea, you might say, in Vermont. Then we crossed over into Massachusetts, again, Williamstown, beautiful college town. Made our way across Massachusetts into Salem, Massachusetts, north of Boston. I don't think anybody's ever succeeded in riding through the city of Boston. Maybe some people will claim to have done it, but I don't know if it's possible. And we finished at the Atlantic Ocean in Salem, Massachusetts. And all I can tell you is that if you do this northern arc, the spectrum of topography and scenery is really vast, and it is varied and engrossing, at times magnificent. I didn't mention the Badlands. We rode through
the Badlands are incredible.
The Badlands is one long photo opportunity. I'd never seen anything like it before. It's kind of a desolate landscape.
But the colors are really special.
With colors,
there, aren't they?
It's got these it's got lunar elements, grays and whites, and it has Martian elements, reds and oranges that blend together. And the rock formations are fantastical.
Yeah.
So the Badlands is just in and of itself a remarkable sight. And like I said, Custer National Forest. We were through the Black Hills of South Dakota,
right?
Mount Rushmore, and then other places like that. So. Riding cross country like that is actually doable. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, a Superman or a freak or obsessive, all of which, or at least some of which, I've been accused of, especially obsessive. My wife's probably listening, nodding her head. But you have to commit to riding every day, all day, every day for X number of days. You can go halfway. You can go all the way. You don't have to ride every day. My goal was to ride every mile every day. That was my goal. Everything else was secondary or a distraction. The weather, a distraction. My goal was every mile every day, and I did that. And to do that, you just have to absorb a lot of things. If you're on a super highway, you just have to absorb the fact that trucks are going to be blasting by at 85 miles an hour. We rode on everything from superhighways to local highways, analogous, for example, to Route 89 to Route 74, all the way down to country roads, and then all the way down to dirt roads. We might have had to take in a detour, all on the same day. You just have to cope with whatever road surfaces that are thrown your way. By the same token, you have to just cope with the weather. You have to deal with the extreme heat, which fortunately this summer we were not lucky. We were lucky enough not to have to cope with. There were not too many instances of truly extreme heat. which could just lay you low. You have to cope with the wind. It's true that the wind is generally is blowing from east to west, so if you go from west to east, you might catch that wind. But in reality, as all bicyclists know, the wind's unfair, and you're going to wind up with a lot of wind in your face. You just got to put your head down, deal with the wind. Deal with the wind, you deal with the heat, the humidity, the sun, all of that. And at the end of the day, you come away with tremendous rewards about what this country can show you in terms of scenery and how rich it is and how the people are generally very benevolent. One question I get asked is, how do you stay on a bicycle 8 hours a day?
That's a good question.
And I developed what I kind of facetiously call seat protection protocols, because you don't want to develop
saddle sores.
Right.
Lesions. And the best way to deal with those is to take steps to prevent them from occurring. And my secret weapon, or the key to it, is something I buy from a pharmacy or drugstore. You can get it right off the shelf, called Lantiseptic. Lantiseptic is a compound. Fran probably knows about it.
That's not what I use.
Well, by the way, I'm going to take in your lecture, because my record for milkshakes in any one day was 3.
All right.
Now, I don't know whether that would meet your criteria for a satisfactory diet for athletics.
My criteria is whatever works for you, and that's what everybody's going to find out.
Oh, it definitely
today.
Worked for me.
Right, right.
Milkshakes after a ride. Record is 3.
And your calorie consumption at 100 and, well, the information that they say is averages about 116 miles a day, but obviously you had a 130 mile day. I mean, you are just burning calories at a real high rate at that point.
I'm a vegetarian. I cleaved to that. But I ate lots of pizza. You'd be surprised out there in the great hinterlands of the country. You can go to these fast food emporiums and you can get very good food. I don't want to mention any names, but I was very satisfied with the pizza and some of the so-called fast food that I ate at chains. I like that. one thing I noticed that when I'm riding on pack tour, I felt this compulsion, or this urge at least, to consume bananas. Every time I stopped at a rest stop, I'd eat a banana. Now, I don't eat bananas at home. I'm not interested in eating bananas, but on pack tour, I'm eating 3, 4, or 5 bananas a day.
That's a good thing to do.
Great, it's
a good
carbohydrate
thing.
Oh,
no,
source.
It's great. Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, then why don't you, if it's so good for you, why don't you sustain that in normal life? I mean, come on, learn the lesson.
Well, it depends on, you know, in this situation, it's very appropriate to eat a lot of them, because it's the neat thing about bananas is they have resistant starch in them. They have a little bit of fast-releasing carbohydrate, but they have a lot of slow-releasing carbohydrate, so they sustain you for the long haul. And then, of course, they have lots of potassium in them, which is going to keep your nerves calm. And so if you had any anxiety going along, the bananas are going to help keep you calm, and they're going to help keep all of your nerves, your musculoskeletal nerves, as well as your, you know, your thought processes.
Any anxiety?
Calm.
Are you kidding? Plenty of anxiety.
Sure.
How am I going to make it through this day? We had one day, 135
know, sure.
miles and 7,000 feet of climbing.
But you have some history here, too. This is not your first one, correct?
I've done 2 northerns and I've done 2 southerns. The southern arc is a little bit different. Actually, it's a lot different, because you go through the arid terrain of the southwest. And the desert is a whole different world of riding.
Yeah. Did you go through Death Valley?
We started in San Diego and headed across into Arizona, then New Mexico. And you say desert. Well, you know, there's all different kinds of desert, I found out.
That's right. The word desert just means an amount of rainfall. The terrain can vary.
Right.
It's like the Black Desert, there's the Sand Desert, and then there's the really hard scrabble.
There's Eastern Oregon
desert.
And Eastern.
There's High Plains Desert.
High Plains
that's right,
desert,
Eastern
right?
Washington, that's High Plains mm-hmm. Desert, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's just an amount of rainfall. The terrain can vary greatly between deserts.
But the desert is, I found it very difficult. And I'm a very white person, as you can see, and I have red hair. And one of the hardest problems for me in riding cross country in the summer, I've done it 4 times, is the fierce sun exposure.
Right. Right.
And you have to, I had to be very scrupulous about applying skin protection, sunscreen, and lip balm and so forth. The sun is completely unmerciless. If you miss your little appointment to have sunscreen, if you forget to put sunscreen on your ears or you forget to put lip balm on your lips, you will be punished for that. And that's a lesson I learned the hard way. You got to protect your skin. And there's different kinds of skin to protect. And I was talking about Lantiseptic, which is used to treat bed sores in hospitals. It's got the antiseptic element, kills bacteria, and at the same time, it's an emollient, and it really is a lubricant. And what I would do is, again, maybe this is what they call too much information or whatever, but at the end of a really long day, let's say you've ridden 130, 140 miles. It's the middle to late afternoon. Once you get into the motel, first thing you do, take off all your cycling clothes. And what I would do is I put them in the sink and do a hand wash.
Right.
And once you do that, next thing you do is you take alcohol and rub yourself down wherever you're sitting on the bicycle.
Perfect.
Copious
Perfect.
Application of isopropyl alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it can hurt. If you have a lesion, it can hurt.
I would do witch hazel.
Or witch hazel. I did. Yeah. That's also, I've tried that too. That's a right fan.
It's a little more forgiving to your body, probably.
And then you put something on. You got to go outside, do your chores, clean the bike, etc. And then before going to bed, what I would do is I would apply antiseptic to the affected areas, as they say. And then the next morning, when I got up, I would reapply the antiseptic. I would also rub antiseptic into the chamois of my shorts.
Sure.
And then on occasion, I would wear a second pair of bicycle shorts.
Wow.
So all I could tell you is that this is what works for me. And I think if you talk to 40 different riders, there are 40 different approaches to handling the issue of how do you forestall saddle sores.
That's true.
What I have done is almost a combination of nuggets of wisdom I've extracted from various riders who told me what they do. But what the antiseptic does is it prevents your skin from getting wet, because I think that once your skin gets wet, then the abrasion starts.
Sure.
Right.
The antiseptic creates a barrier. It's like a seal.
Right.
And you could ride all day, as I did, and I had no problems whatsoever with abrasions or skin lesions there where you sit. And let's face it, when you think about it, you're actually... They're two tiny, very small, really intense pressure points where you sit.
Yes, there are.
And hour after hour of intense pressure is imposed upon these two relatively small areas. At the end of the day, you're going to be sore. You're going to hurt. But the main thing is the skin integrity remains preserved, and that's the way I do it. That has worked for me.
You know, the brevet riders, the people that there used to be a brevet here called the Montreal-Boston BMB, which is like 750 miles in as few days as you could possibly do it. It's something they use actually for getting ready and training for Race Across America, that sort of thing. But those brevet riders that I know that are very serious about it, they all wear two pair of shorts.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that. It indicates what I thought was my own idiosyncratic choice.
Somebody should come up with brevet shorts. They should come up with a special chamois good for...
But I think that the friction of the shorts against one another, I think there's something to the movement with the two pairs of shorts, actually.
Oh, all right.
So if you have this one really big pad or diaper, whatever you want to call it, underneath you, maybe it's just a little too much. Plus, it can't breathe and absorb as well as, a couple of layers.
Kind
of like we wear layers when it gets cold out,
you know.
So it would be on that same principle. All I know is everyone who is doing these, 200, 300, 400, 600 kilometer rides, they're using two pairs of shorts.
It occurs to me somehow to mention this lesson that I have learned over and over from my cycling. I'm an athlete, competitor. As I said, maybe some would accuse me of being argumentative and overly competitive and so forth. But one lesson I learned is that that person standing over there, you don't think is athletic. You don't think is even much of a rider. That person is a formidable, outstanding powerful rider.
You just never
over
know.
Over and over again.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, you just look at these body types and you go, no. And then you realize that, you know, they would be very happy to spend 150 miles on the bike every day.
And they're
well,
out there.
People who ride, randonneurs are often big people.
They are. They are.
Because I think in order to sustain that level of, because, you know, when you're a randonneur, you don't go fast. You just go long.
You just go.
Long.
Right.
Long. 130 miles, they would laugh at you. I'm not kidding. I mean, really. I mean, they
I
wear,
know. Yeah.
They do brevets and 600-mile brevets, and although they don't do it. They do it in a shot over several days. But they're often big people because I think to sustain that level of activity, you have to have extra fat stores.
Some of the stories of people who are on these tours are really quite interesting. There was a person on this theme of on this tour who, when I first saw him, he was walking with a cane. And I thought, well, he must be a friend or relative of one of the riders because he's not a rider. Well, even though he was walking with a cane, he was on the tour and he was a formidable bicyclist. What had happened to him was that he'd suffered a horrific encounter with a motorist. A motorist had hit him from behind at like 45 miles an hour. Over he went. Serious injuries. One of his legs underwent multiple fractures, needed surgical repair, rotting, and that leg was still in the process of callus formation and rejoining of the bones of his, I think, his, whether it was his femur or one of the bones of the lower leg. He was still on the mend from that horrific accident, which had occurred about 18 months before. But there he was on a bicycle, and he was riding with tremendous force and strength.
And he's riding 100-plus miles a day after having that encounter.
He was not riding every day, but he was riding probably 4 or 5 days in a row. Then he'd take a rest day, get on the bike, and he'd be riding strong on any given day that he chose to ride.
Wow.
And I'll say something else, that there are many women who are on the tour who are exceptional riders.
We can do that.
Women are better at the longer distances than men are, actually. They seem to, you have extra fat stores, most women do, because their body fat count.
And what's the joke that you say about me in riding, about at a long ride?
Oh, she's like the Ever Ready Bunny. She just keeps going and going, but she kicks in at the end. She always kicks in at the end.
And I kick in at what mile point?
Well, about 30 miles into a ride, Fran finally starts to warm up. And then she's kind of like on the ride at the beginning of the ride. And then at the end of the ride, she is the ride. And everyone's kind of chasing her. But that's...
These tours, they're not supposed to be races.
Correct.
No.
As you all, anybody in this room knows that if you put... one bicyclist is a solo, but two bicyclists riding together is a race.
Pretty much.
It does seem that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What's with that?
So there's always this undercurrent of competition. But
But you said you rode by yourself a lot.
Yes.
And that is, so that's a standard thing where you'll find yourself riding alone, or you'll ride maybe with two or three other people. What's the norm there?
Most of the time I rode alone, but after I banged up my shoulder, I hitched up with some people for company. I rode with some people for a while. And then any given day, you might wind up, for comfort, hitching on with a little affinity group. And you ride 30 to 40, 50 miles. Sometimes you'll team up with somebody. You'll take turns helping each other in on a particularly windy or a tough day. So on any given day, I might ride quite a bit by myself, but I also might have found myself riding with a group of people or a
How
couple
do you
people.
Know where to go?
You have a route map. You get a very detailed map.
Yeah.
You get these pages that are encased in plastic, and you just they're quite detailed and quite reliable too.
So you have to keep looking down at your at a piece of paper to know where the turns are.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
They're not marked on the road.
They're not. Yeah.
Okay.
And on many days, the turns are quite well marked on the road as well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So somebody comes
out
and does road markings.
See, PacTour has this kind of down to a science.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
everything
I would think so.
Is really it's very detail oriented. They know where to go. They know the ins and outs, the vagaries. If a problem arises, they know how to solve it. All the work's been done in advance, so if you want to do this tour, they will help you succeed, and all you got to do is pedal. which is not to say it's a magic carpet ride. It's very hard. But if you want to succeed, Pactor will make sure that you succeed.
That's nice.
Yeah, that is nice. So you don't have to worry about where you're sleeping that night or anything like that. This is all arranged for you.
It's all arranged for you. You only have to worry about whether where you're sleeping is habitable.
Right. But I did hear you say that you're kind of doing your own laundry. You're kind of rinsing things out and...
I would do my own laundry every day. They try to put you in hotels where you could do a laundry, and if you're in a town where there's a laundromat, they'll tell you. They'll post laundromats, places to eat, and so forth. What I did every night was I took all my dirty laundry, everything I was wearing, I put it in the motel room sink. They provide you with detergent, so I had the detergent, mm-hmm. and I would let that my shorts, my jersey, and my socks soak. And then do my chores. And when I came back, took a shower, cleaned just everything off in the shower. And then when I went out to get dinner, I would put all my laundry out to dry. And you'll always find a place where you can hang your laundry. You find a tree or, some fencing, whatever. Most of the time, it's so hot and the humidity's low, everything that you put out will dry in a matter of hours. I'd say almost every day, by the time I got my laundry back, picked it up, brought it back into the room, it was quite satisfactorily dry. So every day I was riding basically clean clothes. And I'll tell you one thing. Lantiseptic has a way of working itself into the chamois.
Sure, mm-hmm. yeah. Any chamois cream you do, I think
would
it
know
does
that.
Yeah.
Even though you're soaking the shorts in detergent,
yeah.
it did not... The detergent did not succeed in leaching the antiseptic out of the chamois. So
right.
as time passes, the chamois becomes more and more emollient.
It's
and it's
seasoned.
Functioning better.
You actually season your chamois. And I don't use antiseptic. I use a more naturally
boy.
Based, because I looked at what antiseptic is. Antiseptic, it's called lan because it has lanolin. Mm-hmm. You got it. Yes, has lanolin in it. That's the main nice ingredient in it. And then it's the second ingredient in it is beeswax. And it's got some other stuff in it. It's got hydantoin, has lanolin alcohol, and it does have mineral oil and petrolatum, which makes me not too excited about it. It also has boric acid, sodium borate, and it has sorbitan, which is a mold inhibitor. So that's interesting. It does actually have some
Fran,
mold inhibitor.
This sounds pretty good to me, everything you've said so far about
lanolin. I know. Well, you are using it, and you're successful using it, so I would say go ahead and use it. Obviously, it's okay for
yeah.
you. I get a little concerned about people using petroleum products on their skin all the time. Just because, they're not really ultimately good for your skin to have on them. There's some concerns. I mean, it's very, very unlikely, but there's possible carcinogenesis just because it's a petroleum product. And so I use the products that I use have as a base shea butter and cocoa butter and essential oils. And it does basically the same
okay.
thing as what you're doing. And yet, but when you have shea butter and cocoa butter and beeswax, those things are healthy for your skin. They're nutritive and also antimicrobial. And the essential oils are antimicrobial. So you're accomplishing the same thing. And I get that the seasoning of the chamois with the stuff that I use
That's
also
good.
Happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Fran has a whole science
to me,
getting herself ready to go for a bike ride.
Because I'm a very delicate flower
you are
myself.
A delicate flower.
And
yes,
I had
it's
to.
It's all true.
Yes, and mine involves having the right saddle. There's only one saddle I can ride, or else I chafe horribly.
When it comes to, by the way, these, how are we doing? When it comes to these hotels, the range of accommodations, again, if my focus was to get it done every day. So if the motel was substandard, it didn't bother me. It kind of jiggled off my back or ran off my back. But there was one hotel which it has kind of a reputation among the pack tour riders. It's the motel where you're offered, do you want the centipede room? Do you want the arachnid room?
Oh, no.
Do you want the roach room?
Oh, that can't be good.
There are some rough places. There are also
some
first class places, really luxurious accommodations. It makes you think, I wish I could stay here another night, but you can't.
Mike said the same thing last week. He had some interesting experiences
yeah,
out
but
there.
But that's part of the adventure. I urge people to think about doing things like this, even if it's only 2 weeks, and go halfway cross country. For example, I talked about the northern. If you go through the southern, you go through the the Southwest, which is amazing. You know, New Mexico. In New Mexico, we went across one river three times in one day.
It's called the Snake River.
They wrap around, Snake River.
And then in the Deep South, we stayed in Andersonville, Georgia, which is a little known fact. There's a national prisoner of war museum, and we visited that museum. We stayed in places like Winslow, Arizona.
Did you stand on a corner?
Yes, I did.
Did you take your picture?
Yes, I did.
Yeah,
awesome.
There you go.
But anyway,
very good.
So I guess in summary, I want to say that...
Was it such a fine sight that you saw? All right, I'll stop.
Okay, you got to stop now. We're going to actually have to wrap this up. We're getting towards the end of the show. This has been fascinating. My guest today was Bob Enright, the pack tour guy from this summer's radio show and podcast. So if you've been listening to this on a regular basis, then you have heard me talk about Bob. And Bob, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks a lot,
and
Ron.
And also
really
being an avid listener to the show, too. I have a little thing here, final wrap-up. We've got coming up very soon, November 11th, 2016, we have the Bike Walk Connecticut Annual Dinner and Silent Auction. And if you need to find out more about that, that is at www.bikewalkct.org. And you can join them at Central Connecticut State University on Friday, November 11th for their annual dinner and silent auction. There will be a guest speaker there. It's a really nice event. So anyway, you have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, and our guest, Bob Enright. And this is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. And if you are listening to this on podcast, you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. I'm always up for suggestions and information. This is 91.7 WHUS Storrs, Connecticut. Thank you for listening.